Now, with the latest from the world of technology, this is the Tech Guide Podcast with Stephen Fenwick.
Lots to talk about.
Tech Guide.
It's a very well-rounded product, combines great design, great technology, lots of excellent features.
Tech Guide.
This is why Samsung has seen a huge surge, why their profits are up.
Keeping you updated and educated, this is the Tech Guide Podcast.
This is not an ultrabook. If you're looking for something small, slim and lightweight, then you need to look elsewhere.
Tech Guide.
Probably one of the most impressive little devices I've seen in quite a while.
Now, from the studios of techguide.com.au, Stephen Fenwick.
Tech Guide, episode 102. Hello and welcome to the podcast that keeps you updated and educated about the latest consumer technology. Thanks for listening and thanks for downloading. My name is Stephen Fenwick and I'm the editor of techguide.com.au. On this week's show, we're going to talk about the new SBS hybrid broadcast broadband TV service. And we're going to chat about Amazon's brand new smartphone. In the Tech Guide reviews, we're going to check out Samsung's new 12.2-inch tablet. We're going to also look at Laser's multi-region Blu-ray player and also Plock's Titan portable charger. If you've got a smartphone or tablet, you're going to want to hear about that one. In the Tech Guide interview, we have a special chat with Martin Weist, who's the production designer for the RoboCop reboot, which has just been released on Blu-ray and DVD. And it's all brought to you by Netgear, Australia's number one brand of home Wi-Fi products. Lots to talk about on the show, so let's get cracking. Well, today is Monday, and it was the day that SBS became the first network in Australia to launch a brand new service. It's HBBTV, or otherwise known as Hybrid Broadcast Broadband TV, the first network to offer this service. And what it basically is, it combines broadcast, your usual broadcast TV, with your broadband connection. So in other words, it allows you to access on-demand content without having to leave the broadcast screen. So typically on a smart TV, we would go to an app or to a separate screen or to a tablet to access that information, that on-demand content. Well, not so with HBBTV. A little red button appears in the top left-hand corner. And if you've got a compatible TV, that is, you'll see that dot, and you can press the corresponding red button on your remote control and then be presented with the dashboard of on-demand programming. So a very easy way to access TV shows, movies, documentaries, sports, food programs, you name it. It's an easy way to access that without having to leave that broadcast screen. Now, not every TV can handle HBBTV. You do need a compatible television that has that capability. There are a range of Panasonic TVs that are already in the marketplace that are compatible, that are HBBTV ready. And other models, of course, will follow from Samsung, LG, Sony, TCL, all the major players later this year. So 2014 range onwards, TVs will be able to access this brand new service that SBS has kicked off with, and no doubt other free-to-air channels will follow. There is a possibility that your TV may be able to acquire this ability through a firmware upgrade. That's yet to be confirmed from any of the manufacturers, but stay tuned. We'll keep you up to date with that here on the Tech Guide podcast. And another possibility, if you have an older TV, is to access the service through a brand new Freeview Plus set-top box. Freeview Plus is the initiative that will include HBBTV along with a new electronic program guide, but it will be the way to access all networks on-demand offerings which are going to be offered in this fashion. SBS, good on them for becoming the first network to offer this. They went live today. It's still in what they call the beta phase. So anyone who does have a compatible TV, and they realize not many people do at this stage, but it is a way to get some feedback from the audience to help them make the service an enhancement even better. Because obviously services like this are brand new. They need improving over time. And there are several uses for this technology, I think, that nobody's really thought about yet. One I did discuss with Trevor Long. Trevor Long's actually my partner on the Two Blokes Talking Tech podcast. He's also the innovation manager at SBS, and he actually gave me a run-through of the service. One of the things we discussed was the possibility of accessing content, live content, during a TV show. For example, you're watching a cooking program, and the HBB TV ability, the technology, will possibly allow you to access, actual recipe live during the show, so you can download that. Another possibility would be the ability to buy products featured in certain programs. So, say, for example, you're watching a movie and there's several products that are in the film, then it is quite within the realms of possibility for this technology for there to be a link created through your TV's broadband connection to an online service where you can actually buy those products. So if you see the nice watch that James Bond may be wearing in a Bond film, then this service may be able to connect you to a store to buy that on the spot. So, look, it's early days yet. HBB TV, it's going to offer, obviously, a lot of on-demand content, but the possibilities are still out there, and you do need a compatible TV. If you want to look at the model numbers that are compatible, you can do that at techguide.com.au.
Tech Guide. This is Tech Guide with Stephen Fenwick.
Now, Amazon is not the first thing that comes to mind when you think about smartphones. Well, late last week, they became the latest company to enter the smartphone market. It's a company that we're used to hearing when new e-readers, Kindles, that's their signature device is the Kindle. They're also a massive online store that sell all kinds of products. But just last week, the Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos got up in front of an audience in Seattle and unveiled the new smartphone called the Fire Phone. Now, Fire is the name of one of their Kindles, but Fire Phone is the name of the smartphone, and they've got the market leaders, Samsung and Apple, well and truly within their sights. Now, it's not that Amazon has just put out an average smartphone here that would disappear into the background amongst the countless other devices that are in the market already. I think Amazon knew that for them to be taken seriously in this market, they needed to produce a device that's going to get them some attention. And that attention is gathered by some interesting features on the device. Now, Fire Phone is an Android-powered product, so at its heart, it's running the Android operating system. But it does have a few very interesting features, and I'll take you through them right now. The first is dynamic perspective. Now, this utilizes a camera sensor system so that it can detect the way the phone is being held. Now, I'm not talking about an accelerometer. We're talking about sensors that can detect a swivel, a tilt, can actually let you look behind objects on the screen and as if you're looking out of a window. It also gives you the option of swiveling the device in left or right, up or down, to reveal certain menus so that you literally don't have to touch the screen to access information. This is a handy feature if you're reading a long web page, for example, or perhaps reading an ebook. And that plays right into Amazon's hands because they do sell ebooks. Another new feature is Firefly. Now, this is another new technology that makes it easy to identify content, kind of like Shazam that it can identify music. Firefly takes it even further, so you can actually use Firefly during a TV program, for example, that might be on TV, and it will tell you the TV episode, the TV's name, TV show's name, and you'll be able to then have a direct link, of course, to the Amazon store to download that. Same thing, you can do the same thing with music as well, and other related content. So it's a direct link. Of course, Amazon is a business, and they have a massive store, and the smartphone is going to act as a way to get customers back into the store. Speaking of customers, Amazon has got a very healthy number of customers worldwide that are already registered with the site, who can purchase content at the press of a button, kind of like Apple with its army of customers that are that already have iTunes accounts. So the ability to download content is quite easy. It's literally a couple of clicks away, and you may have purchased a new album, a new song, a new book, a new movie. So I think that's Amazon's end game here, is to not only gather new customers, but to keep the ones they've already got and make it easier for them to access the content in the Amazon store. It's also got a decent camera. It's got a 13-megapixel camera with optical image stabilization, and it takes pretty decent photos from what we heard from the presentation. It's also got a dedicated camera button so that you can capture your images straight away. It's running its own – it's Android's on at the heart of the product, but it's also running on top of that its own UI called the Fire operating system 3.5.0, which sits above Android. The bad news, though, for Australian users is that Amazon's Fire Phone will only be available in the US at first. It's going to be released the end of July. July 25 is the date. It'll be released through the AT&T network. Prices starting at $199 for the 32 gig and $299, 64 gig. They are US prices, and you can also buy it outright on for $649 US, 32 gig, $749 US, 64 gig. No news whether this will come to Australia. It may also be a case where their Australian customers may want to bring this into the country and hopefully find a way for it to work on the Australian networks. It does remind me back in 2007 when the first iPhone was released, wasn't intended for the Australian market, but that did not stop users, including myself, from bringing devices into Australia, cracking them to allow us to run our own Australian SIM cards on board. Will that happen with the Amazon? We don't know, but there's plenty of interest around the device, even though it hasn't even been released yet. The presentation last week was pretty interesting. Those new features, quite compelling. And when it does come out the end of July, we will try our very best to get our hands on it. We may be in the US around that time to get our hands on the device, but we will bring you that in-hand review as soon as we can. You want to read more about that and check out all those new features we discussed? You can do that at techguide.com.au.
Keeping you updated and educated. This is Tech Guide with Stephen Finney.
Tech Guide.
The Tech Guide podcast is proudly supported by Netgear, Australia's number one Wi-Fi brand, and the brand you need to look to increase the connectivity, to enhance the connectivity in your home. Well, they've just released the AC1200 high-powered Wi-Fi range extender, model number EX6200. Now, this is a handy device if you want to extend the range of your Wi-Fi network, and it can incorporate 802.11 AC wireless connectivity, the fastest yet, three times faster than the previous standard of Wi-Fi, and it can then bring your network into those hard-to-reach spots and also connect devices that are in that area of your home to your network. Now you can power up your whole home network with Netgear's new AC1200 high-powered Wi-Fi range extender, the EX6200. Push your Wi-Fi to every corner of the home with the new 802.11 AC Wi-Fi range extender. It's perfect for your home theater setup. You can connect 5 wired devices to the gigabit Ethernet ports on the back, or stream HD video content from a USB hard drive directly into the product's USB 3.0 port. With a powerful dual-core processor on board and high-power amplifiers, you'll have Wi-Fi wherever you want it throughout your home. Get the EX6200, the fastest AC Wi-Fi range extender available from Netgear, and you can check it out at netgear.com.au/maxwifi.
Tech Guide.
Now, a Tech Guide review with Stephen Fenwick. Tech Guide.
All right, we're going to kick off the reviews with a big product. This is Samsung's 12.2-inch Galaxy Note Pro tablet. Now, I've labeled this the Go Big or Go Home device, which is markedly larger than even the 10-inch model. This is quite a big tablet, 12.2 inches. It's only a couple of inches bigger than the 10.1, but boy, it does make a massive difference in that screen size. And look, this is not for everyone. This is a 29.6 centimeter wide device, 20.4 centimeters long, 7.9 mil thick, and it weighs 753 grams. It's pretty hefty. But you do get a lot for your money. Speaking of which, it's priced at $1,099. It's not cheap, but you get a lot of bang for your buck. It's plenty of product here to handle. First of all, that 12.2 inch screen. It is big. It is huge. It is massive. It's ideal, though, for those people who want to take advantage of that added screen real estate, who want to multitask, who want to draw, who want to write notes on a larger screen. There's so many possibilities here. It actually offers a full-size keyboard. The virtual keyboard, when displayed on the screen, is actually a full-size keyboard. We actually found it quite easy to type on this device, and you may do the same thing as well. I think it's aimed at that customer who's thinking, do I buy a laptop? Do I buy a tablet? This is a powerful enough and with a large enough screen to offer that possibility for those on the go who want a device that's going to power them through the day. As a tablet on its own, of course, there's the S Pen, so you can write on the screen. You can also use the AirView and all these other commands that allows you to create action memos, to use the pen window. So, for example, the pen window allows you to just to draw a square and allows another app to be working in that little space. You can run up to four different apps at the same time on the 12.2 inch screen. So that's multitasking at its best. And you can drag and drop things between those open apps as well. It does help if you are using this for work. Speaking of work, there is some software on board that allows you to read Microsoft Office documents. You can update that on board. It's called the Hanson application, available from the Samsung App Store, and it will allow you to view the Hancom Office, which the version included on the device only allows you to read documents. If you did want to update that and create and edit documents, you just pay the Samsung App Store for the full version. The other features, as I mentioned, that typing on the virtual keyboard, that does help in your productivity. It's got not a bad camera on board either. If you've got enough strength to hold up this device long enough to take a photo, the pictures are actually surprisingly good. And that S Pen for the writing those notes. The screen is about the size of an A4 piece of paper, which is interesting for those who want to draw, who want to take notes, who want to just use that screen, who like that tactile feel of a pen in their hand. It's very responsive. The S Pen is a lot like writing on a real piece of paper. Performance-wise, you're talking quad-core processor. It's got LTE, that's 4G connectivity on board, as well as Wi-Fi, as well as Bluetooth. And it can also be synced with your PC. So this is probably a laptop replacement possibility for many users. It is $1,099. Battery lasted quite a while too. Being a large device, the advantage of that is having a large battery. And this is no exception. The battery lasted a couple of days during our review process, which is a delight if you are using this for work or play. You can watch movies on that large screen, which we did. It was lovely to watch it on such a big screen. Just holding it in your hand for a long time, it can get a bit heavy. There are some accessories available, so you can stand it up with a cover. There's also a keyboard case too, so that there's a slot for you to position the Note Pro, and there's a full-size keyboard, a physical keyboard for you to use as well. The Samsung 12.2-inch Galaxy Note Pro, priced at $1,099. It's also available through Optus and Telstra on a contract if you don't want to buy it outright. It isn't cheap, but it is a large product. You do get a lot for your money. But if you want to read my full review, you can do that at techguide.com.au. Blu-ray players are set to region codes. Reason for this is that back in the DVD days when DVDs were becoming popular in the mid to late 90s, it wasn't uncommon for the US to be releasing a DVD, a film on DVD, around the same time that same film was being released in cinemas here in Australia. Hence the reason why region codes were invented, so release schedules could be contained within the countries they were meant for. So that's why Australia was region 4 in DVD, US was region 1. There were ways to get around that. So if you had a multi-region DVD player, that was a way to be able to play any DVD on your device. Now, moving up to Blu-ray, and regions were also introduced, this time region A, B, and C, of which Australia is region B. And Laser has just released a product called the BD1000, which is a multi-region Blu-ray player. So if you're like me and you do a bit of traveling or a bit of collecting and you buy movies on your journeys, on your travels, now you don't even need to worry about the region coding for it to play on your machine at home. Many a time I have brought home DVDs and Blu-rays, or Blu-rays in particular, thinking they were going to play on my Blu-ray player when I got home, and unfortunately they didn't, and I ended up with a very, very expensive drink coaster. So now with the BD1000, it can play DVDs from all, Blu-rays and DVDs for that matter, from all regions. So there's no worry now of you bringing home a very expensive drink coaster. Now it's not, this isn't just also to beat those release schedules. There are movie collectors out there who would like different versions of the same film. There may be a film that has different extra features possibly in the US than it does here in Australia. Maybe even a different version of the entire film is available in other countries and not here in Australia. So this, having this as in your entertainment unit, can help prevent there being any kind of mishap and there being an incompatibility with your disc when you bring it home. It's priced at only $99. So even if you do own a Blu-ray player and it's maybe that particular player may be locked to a particular region, then the Laser for only $99 can help you get around that problem. It's a great second player for those movies that you brought home that you want to make sure they play. You can enjoy them when you get them back here in Australia. Laser BD1000 multi-region Blu-ray player. It can also play DVDs as well, so don't think you've got to throw your DVD collection out. It plays all your discs, Blu-ray and DVD, and multi-region across the board for DVD as well as for Blu-ray. You can get that right now. It's available at Big W, The Good Guys, and Harvey Norman, $99. You want to see what it looks like and read my review? You know where to go, techguide.com.au. Our next product in the reviews is the Plox Titan Portable Charger. Might not sound like much, but this is the sort of device that's going to get you out of trouble. How often have you looked down at your smartphone and seen you've only got 10% battery and yet you're going to be out for hours and hours without any access to a PowerPoint? Well, that panic can be over now if you do own the Plox Titan. This is a portable charger that has got 11,200 milliamp capacity, which is enough power to recharge an iPhone 5 8 times. Now, this is a device that's about 11.5 centimetres wide, 7.4 centimetres long, and 2.25 centimetres thick. Weighs 250 grams, so it's not too big. It's slightly thicker and wider than a smartphone, but yet small enough to fit in your bag. Now, there are two USB ports on the product, and if you bring your charging cable and connect your USB side to the Plox Titan and the micro USB side or lightning side to your smartphone or iPhone, then you'll be able to charge on the move. So if you don't have time to sit next to a PowerPoint for an hour and a half while your device is being charged, the Plox Titan can do it on the go, which is very handy for those who are using their devices constantly. It can charge a smartphone, can charge a tablet, any USB powered device, even like a GPS, a portable gaming device, a camera. The Plox Titan can handle it all, and with that massive capacity, it can do it several times. It's a sort of device where charge it up once, charge it up on a Sunday night, put it in your bag all week, and it will be able to charge every day for that week if necessary. So you're not going to be caught short without a charge when you're on the move with the Plox Titan. The Plox Titan is priced at $99 and comes with free shipping when you order it through the website. I've put a link on techguide.com.au. You can check it out right there and never be short of a charge again.
Tech Guide now. Tech Guide interview.
Tech Guide.
Our Tech Guide interview is with all the way from Hollywood. We're talking to Martin Weiss. Now, he's the production designer for the recently rebooted version of RoboCop. Now, Martin has quite a resume. He's been production designer on several films in the past, including Cloverfield, that great J.J. Abrams film, Super 8, another J.J. Abrams film, Warm Bodies. He's also working right now on the very latest edition of Night at the Museum. I think it's the third film in the Night at the Museum films. So he's got quite the resume. So he's a very talented fellow, Mr. Martin Weiss. And we had a chat to him, asked him about RoboCop and what it meant to remake what many consider a classic film, including myself. I'm a big fan of the original RoboCop. And Martin was good enough to chat to us over the phone from LA. So excuse the quality issues here. We did our very best to record it in the best quality. But he was very kind enough to give us not only his time, but also to give us a bit of technical detail on how he does his work and how he produces all the various models and sets and everything you see on the screen. And here's what he had to say earlier. Hi, Martin. Thanks for joining me. We're here to talk RoboCop, and you had quite a role in the reboot. You're the production designer, so tell us a little bit about the thoughts coming into this film, knowing that there was already a version out there, and the kind of pressures you faced bringing a reboot to the screen.
You have to be cautious, and being fans, you'll say myself and some of the filmmakers, we wanted to be respectful and basically give a real big nod of our hat to the original, while of course at the same time kind of do our own thing to it and upgrade it and contemporize it and, you know, change the story, of course, but also maintain a lot of links to the original and similarities of the things that we truly love about the first story.
Sure, and it looks obviously a very high-tech film. I'm a tech writer, and this is a tech podcast, so I obviously want to get your take on the kinds of technology you use for the research, the creation of the costumes, the whole design behind the film. So take us a bit through that. What sort of tech did you use to bring this vision to life?
Well, I do run a pretty, in film design now in Hollywood, we have the opportunity to run a pretty high quality tech art department. A lot of the set designers and illustrators work in most of the latest 3D visualization programs, you know, from set design ones that might be CAD based into programs such as Rhino, which I love, which does CAD and also gets us into the three-dimensional modeling and visualization, and then, of course, into our Form Zs and our Maya and for really modeling and rendering out our 3D concepts. So almost everything that, in terms of sets and the vehicles and the design of the suit and all the other robots, were rendered to a pretty realistic level before I pulled the trigger on actually manufacturing them. And, of course, now with the 3D printing and growing capabilities that we have out there, we are very deep into that, and with the suit, for example, by the time I was finished modeling and rendering the suit in our 3D world, computer world, I had essentially completed my task apart from dealing with the reality of the real world reality of painting it or giving it its sheen. Because basically the translation from our 3D modeling and designing of the suit was direct to the growing of the pieces of the suit. So unlike back not so many years ago, with the project like this, you conceptualize it and you get to a certain point, but then of course you'd be pretty much hand sculpting pieces and pulling molds and using pretty standard sculpting practices to create these forms, and then you would be making them out of fiberglass or what have you, mm-hmm. and then painting them. So now the capability for growing was very, very instrumental in making this suit. For the designer, it was, fantastic because I was able to go over every inch, centimeter, millimeter of the suit and model it to the point that I wanted, sculpt it in the computer to the exact point I wanted, knowing that it was going to be a direct translation to output. So that's the suit. The sets as well, we get to a pretty high grade rendered concept of the sets before I start building them. But there's always a translation, because it's architecture and space, and it's just slightly different where once I leave the 3D world and the computer, I get into traditional drafting, and a lot of things come out with that that you just kind of don't, you think you know in the computer, you think you can see these things in architectural space, but for the most part, things modify just slightly as we get into the two-dimensional
I was going to ask that, actually. I was going to say, it's one thing to design it on a computer and even do a 3D printout, but then the actors have to wear, in this case, the RoboCop suit. So how accurate were your designs and how easily did he fit in? Was it a process, or did you get it right the first time?
Well, back to the suit, we scanned Joel Kinnaman, his body. We did a full body scan on him. So we had his exact form to put inside the suit, inside our three-dimensional suit, as well as being able to sculpt the exterior. So the interior spatial relationships were pretty well advanced before we even made the suit. And but of course, there, once it was made and we fit Joel, and this then went very much over to Legacy, which is the company that built the suit and sort of responsible for the upkeep, maintaining the daily onset maintenance of the suit. They're the real professionals in knowing how it works functionally. But during the design process, I was very conscious and wanted to have their input as I designed, because I didn't want to design some elements of the suit that were just, they don't work. The shoulder doesn't rotate. The arms can't bend properly. He can't run well. All those types of concerns, I really wanted input as we went. So I worked very closely once I got to the final design stages with Legacy to get their input to make sure that I was as close as possible. I was as happy as possible with my design and as functional as possible in the real world. But to your question, once it actually got output and produced, there was still a fitting phase of which minor modifications had to take place. But it was pretty darn smooth. It was kind of amazing how, due to the body scan of our actor and the precision of these of our programs that and the 3D printing of the actual elements and pieces of the suit, it was pretty amazing how relatively seamless it was once it went onto the actor.
Fantastic. And you mentioned the vehicles were also a factor. There's plenty of those in the film and the whole futuristic look. How much easier now? You must have some computing power in your design studio there. What sort of machines are you using? Are you Mac people, Windows people? What's the basic tool you're using in there?
We're all Mac pretty much, and the tools, it depends on the designer. People have different preferences. I mean, we use ZBrush a fair amount with the suit. Like I said, Form Z, Maya, they're good for kind of, well, Maya anyway is a little better for sets because it just renders really well. For the cars, the vehicles themselves, you know, we use whatever was the best tool for the actual design, like the set designer and illustrator. But that was one where I got pretty close with the designs, and but that was one that when you're dealing with a vehicle and having to modify a real vehicle to make it look more futuristic, there's a lot of real, you sort of standing there, hands-on, pointing, talking, moving, trying out a little template, seeing if it works, if the wheels turn properly. So there's similar to sets, with vehicles, there's a little more of the hands-on modification. Although that being said, with the bike, which was a big deal, the design in the computer was pretty darn advanced by the time we put it onto the frame, and I modified a Kawasaki 1000, extended the wheelbase, and basically stripped it and then reclad it with all of our designed pieces. And, you know, of course, it was more of a computer-generated design process with the bike than a lot of the other cars. But there was still, without a doubt, that having to look at the physical object, get a guy on it, see how he fits, see what's wrong, what's right, how he can, you know, use his center of gravity and his weight to actually move the vehicle so that, and then we would modify things based on that. So, yeah.
Great. Well, really, really appreciate your time, Martin. Thanks for joining us on Tech Guide.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And that's the end of another show. You can read more about everything we've talked about at techguide.com.au. Before we sign off, a special thanks to our sponsors, Netgear, the brand you can trust for all your Wi-Fi needs. If you want to stay connected, the answer is Netgear. Thanks for listening. It's been great having your company, and we look forward to you joining us again next week. So until then, as we always say, stay safe and stay connected.